Chapter 9. You'd like him. You'd be proud of him. And every time I see his face, I think of yours, and your voice, and what I might have had to guide me. And every time I think of your voice, I think of the monstrous creature that might have whispered to me with it. And if I had that creature, I would have your ghost, and listen to it. So all in all, I suspect I have done right, and my longings are my own to bear. But that's being the Illuminate Majesty, isn't it? You always said so. I wished you'd believed it. The private notes of Her Brilliance the Emperor 19 adds, undated, locked, and encrypted. This is a terrible idea. What animal doesn't come back from a long hunt hungry for scraps? But you don't want to hear Pretty Takes Kalanli rhetoric, do you? You want something direct. How about this? Every fleet officer I've ever met would get greedy enough to take a little detour into Station Conquering if they were bored enough and had the opportunity of legal proximity. Fuck off about this and give me another year to work. You'll get your precious isolation. From a letter written by Ambassador Yaskander Agavan to Daj Taratz, Counselor for the Miners. Received on LaSalle Station 101.2.11-6D, Takes Kalanli Reckoning. 8 Antidote came into the Ministry of War through the front door, like he was supposed to be there. Like he'd won the right to be there, which he guessed he had. 3 Azimuth had told him to come, and Her Brilliance had, well, she'd given him the strange charge of the spear point in the middle of the night. The spear point and the command, find out if 3 Azimuth means to win this war. He was still chewing that over, the idea of it like a raw place in his mouth where a baby tooth had fallen out, and a new one hadn't come in yet. Whatever it meant, though, he had double permission to come in the front way instead of from the tunnels. He'd hidden the spear point in the drawer where he kept his shirts, a bright, heavy secret, nestled amongst the grays and the golds and the reds. 11 Laurel was waiting for him just inside. 8 Antidote abruptly remembered that he hadn't even touched his problem-set puzzle, and wondered if there was time to turn around and pretend he had ended up here by accident. There wasn't, and anyway, running off was what a kid would do, so he wouldn't. Hello, Undersecretary, he said, and bowed over his fingertips, inclined just so far, like he was greeting an equal. It felt squirmy and wrong, and great, to presuppose that he and the 3rd Undersecretary of the Ministry of War, his teacher and his elder by 50 years at least, was someone he didn't have to bow very far to. Cure, said 11 Laurel, warm and pleased with him. 8 Antidote was blushing by the time he stood up. He hated being so obvious. He shouldn't be this obvious. I think you will enjoy today, the Undersecretary went on. We have just received some intelligence from the 24th Legion, and the Minister of War thinks you, my young friend, ought to get to see it analyzed. I'd like that a very great deal, 8 Antidote said, trying to remember who was in charge of the 24th Legion. Not Yautlek, 9 Hibiscus. It had been the 10th at Kuran. The 10th was the dangerously loyal one. But another woman, with an astronomical aspect to the noun half of her name. He'd done just one exercise with the 24th as part of a puzzle, a long time ago, back at the very beginning of when 11 Laurel was teaching him. But he knew the 24th was one of 9 Hibiscus's Yautlek's 6, her complement of legions to work with on the edge of the battlefront. Not from the 10th? He asked, following 11 Laurel through the warren of the Ministry of War. That's interesting. A good observation, Cure, said 11 Laurel. No, our intelligence is straight from Fleet Captain 16 Moonrise, on fast courier relay through the jump gates. She very much wanted the Ministry to have this information right away. I'm extremely curious myself as to what it is she wants to show us. 16 Moonrise. Eight Antidote had to remember the name this time. At least he'd gotten the astronomical part right. But it'd be much easier to remember her name now that she wasn't a collection of holographs on a strategy table, and instead a fleet captain who went above, or around, her Yautlex's command in order to send intelligence to war back in the city. For the first time, Eight Antidote wondered if Nine Hibiscus knew that there were elements in the ministry that had sent her to war, hoping she was going to die in it. He figured she must. She wasn't stupid. No one who could command loyalty like that was stupid. They couldn't be. He was pretty sure. But maybe she was the kind of person who thought that loyalty protected her. That since all her soldiers loved her so very well, and she loved the Empire, she must if 19 ads had made her Yautlex, then the Ministry of War would love her and protect her as well. That seemed like the kind of mistake a person who relied on loyalty would make. He'd have to remember not to make it when he was emperor. Loyalty wasn't transitive. It didn't move up and down the chain of command smoothly. It could get cut off or rerouted, especially if someone else powerful was intervening in the movement of information, like Fleet Captain 16 Moonrise was right now. 11 Laurel didn't take him to one of the strategy rooms this time. They went up an elevator in the center of the palms instead, and through a series of very secure checkpoints staffed with fleet soldiers, into what must have been Minister 3 Azimuth's very own office. It was covered in star charts, beautiful ones on the walls, artists' renderings of Tixkalanli space, with pride of place behind the minister's desk taken by a vast and glimmering mosaic in a frame. Dark crystal slices and golden pinpoint stars made out of glass pieces smaller than Eight Antidote's littlest fingernail. It was a famous piece, The World, it was called, or sometimes just Tixkalan, a map of everywhere the Empire had touched as of 200 years ago, when it was made by the artisan 18 Coral. Eight Antidote had seen it in Holo and on Infofiche, but never before in person. It lived behind the desk of the Minister of War. Of course he'd never seen it in person. There were maps everywhere, though. On the large table in front of that desk, some holographic and some paper ones, too. On the desk itself, in piles, pinned to the walls next to and overlapping the famous and artistic renderings. Minister 3 Azimuth sat amongst her cartography, like a bird in a well-lined nest, her cloud hook glowing silver-white and translucent over the wreckage of her melted ear, her hair a smooth, dark cap. Eight Antidote swallowed, his throat feeling suddenly thick, and quickly looked away from her to the other ministry officials seated around the table to her right and left. There was Undersecretary 7 Astor of the Second Palm, the Master of Supply Chains, and his staff, immediately recognizable by how the hands in their shoulder patches had their fingers pointing to the left. Next to him was 22 Thread, the Fifth Palm, the armaments chief, who had come to give a presentation on new sorts of spaceship engines to Eight Antidote's ancestor the Emperor 2 years ago. Eight Antidote had fallen asleep while she was talking. But he'd been a little kid then. He wouldn't do that kind of thing now. 11 Laurel's own staff were waiting for him on the other side of the table. Two women Eight Antidote didn't know, both wearing patches figured with downward-pointing hands for the third palm, on their shoulders next to their rank sigils, and two empty chairs, one for 11 Laurel and one for him. He sat down, like he belonged, like he wasn't 11 years old. At the end of the table, opposite the minister, was an empty space where the Emperor would have gone, if she'd been invited. Presumably, if whatever was about to be discussed was important enough, she would be. Probably. Unless the Ministry of War was hiding something from 19 ads. But that was what he would have to watch for, wasn't it? Being careful. Paying attention. That's what he'd been asked to do, in the middle of the night. 11 Laurel, said the minister, nodding welcome and then looked right at him and said, Your Excellency, Eight Antidote. Thank you both for coming. I'm going to play a transmission from Fleet Captain 16 Moonrise now. It came in on fast courier a few hours ago. Priority communication. Eight Antidote was profoundly grateful that the room lights dimmed when the transmission started, so no one could see that he was blushing, his cheeks hot, just from being addressed directly by 3-Azimuth with his entire formal title. It was embarrassing and ridiculous. Lots of people called him Your Excellency, and he didn't usually blush at all. In Hollow, Fleet Captain 16 Moonrise of the 24th Legion looked like a statue in a plaza, visible only from the waist up in full 360-degree reproduction and hovering above the table. She bowed over her fingers, or she had about 6 hours ago. 6.5. It took at least that long for a transmission to cross all the jump gates between the battlefront and the city, even on fastest courier, and being bounced across sectors by the strongest repeater stations. Wherever she was, 6 hours ago had been dim and metal-walled. Some ship. She was alone. "A message for Minister 3-Azimuth," she said. "Priority. Security code Hyacinth." She was speaking softly, just loud enough that her recorder could catch each syllable, but not loud enough for anyone to overhear her. 8-Antidote had never heard of security code Hyacinth before. He glanced at the faces of the adults around the table. They showed no obvious surprise or consternation, only attentiveness. "The fleet has obtained the corpse of one of our enemies and conducted an autopsy on the alien. A formal report of the autopsy will arrive from Yautlek 9 Hibiscus's medical team in due course, I'm sure, and I am equally sure that it will be accurate but brief. I myself observed the conclusion of the autopsy. The aliens are mammalian, likely to be scavengers and carnivorous or omnivorous based on their dentition. More significantly, however, the Yautlek invited a special envoy from the Ministry of Information to be present at the autopsy as well. The envoy brought with her a foreign national from Lascelles Station. I have enclosed a visual image of the stationer. It is my belief that Lascelles Station may be attempting to exert diplomatic influence over the decisions of Yautlek 9 Hibiscus via the person of the information envoy, whom 9 Hibiscus has commanded to initiate first contact protocols. The Palms should be aware of the possibility that information may contain compromised individuals, or that the stationers may be infringing on Taixkalanli sovereignty. In sending this message, I perform my duty as a sworn officer of the fleet. May Taixkalan and the Emperor endure 1,000,000 years. End security code Hyacinth." The hollow ended, and 16 Moonrise vanished as if she'd never been. The lights came back up. Minister 3-Azimuth sat back in her chair, her fingers laced together in front of her chest. She did not look like someone who had just been told that there was a foreign diplomat conspiring with a rogue information agent running loose around the battlefield of a thus far unwinnable war. 8-Antidote would like to look that confident someday. And she was small, not much taller than him. And yet she appeared every inch the master of all 6 palms, the encompasser of the Empire's military mind. She blinked behind her cloud hook, and a 2-dimensional image of a tallish woman in a foreign-cut jacket and trousers, high-cheekboned and curly-haired, replaced the hollow of 16 Moonrise above the table. The image was fuzzy at the edges, the angle strange. 8-Antidote thought it had been pulled off a security camera. But he knew that face. He'd seen that face splashed across news feeds over and over after 6 Direction died. He'd seen it close up, too, in one of the garden rooms in Palace Earth, the Huitzahuitlam garden, where he went to watch the hummerbirds sip nectar and fly only as far as their invisible netting allowed them. She'd spoken to him then. "So," 3-Azimuth said, "what do we think of the former ambassador from Lascelles Station, Mahit Dasmar?" "She, if you recall, of the heartfelt plea that we notice the alien threat. The one broadcast right before the Emperor 6 Direction's death. The one who gave us the direction of our war. Since that esteemed individual is who has just shown up on Wait for the Wheel." In the garden, surrounded by the buzzing red and gold wings of the tiniest birds in Taixkalan, Dismar had made him a strange offer. She'd said to him, "You're a very powerful young person. and if you still want to, when you are of age, LaSalle Station would be honored to host you. And he'd known better, right then, as he knew better right now, than to say yes. She'd been lost and drunk and sad, and still trying to find an angle of influence. So he'd shown her how to get the Huitzahuitlam to drink nectar from her palm, and then sent her away. He wondered what she'd learned from that night, and what had driven her first away from Tixcalan, and then out to the battlefront itself. Eight Antidotes sat up straight and paid attention. This conversation was one he'd have to bring back to Her Brilliance, the Emperor. Even little spies have secrets, he thought to himself, and was surprised by the degree of his own satisfaction at the idea. The Ministry of War didn't like Mahit Dismar, it turned out, or at least some of them didn't. She was a barbarian. That was just true. And Second Undersecretary Seven Aster, who was new as Minister Three Azimuth, as new as the Emperor herself, mostly seemed to dislike her because she was a barbarian and was out on a battlefront unsupervised, while possibly having diplomatic authority. That didn't seem to be Dismar's fault, though. She couldn't help being a barbarian, or that the information envoy had brought her along. Unless she'd somehow made the envoy take her. The last ambassador from LaSalle Station, Yaskandar Agavan, had seemed like the sort of person who made people do things they never expected. Eight Antidote hadn't known him, except for knowing the shape of his face and how much his ancestor the Emperor had enjoyed his companionship. Agavan either hadn't liked kids that much, or had better things to do than talk to one. But he'd been in the palace all the time. He'd been friends with everyone. Until he died. Maybe all LaSalle ambassadors were like that. Eight Antidote was still considering whether being good at making people act in ways they usually wouldn't would be helpful or unhelpful on a battlefront, when 11 Laurel said,
Minister, my chief concern with Dismar has nothing to do with her barbarian origins. It is to do with her effects on situations around her, her destabilizing effects.
Go on, said Minister Three Azimuth. As you keep reminding me, Undersecretary, you were here when Dismar was involved with the unfortunate circumstances surrounding our Emperor's ascension to the throne, and I was not. Is there something specific about her activities, then, that you think is indicative?
You were very busy on Nakar. I'm sure you didn't have time to notice these small things,
said 11 Laurel, which seemed to Eight Antidote like an innocuous statement that really didn't deserve Three Azimuth's quick, displeased expression. She had been on Nakar, and military governors were busy by nature, almost as busy as emperors.
Dismar, and the forces that she either allied herself with or who found her useful, ignores all protocols. She ignores all history. She, like a Agavan before her, just slides blithely in and does what she believes is necessary. And if the institutions of our empire are disregarded, our processes dissolved or lost, what is it to her?
Three Azimuth's face was very still.
My dear Undersecretary, she said, I assume you are talking about the early retirement of my predecessor, Nine Propulsion.
Eight Antidote was suddenly aware of how much older 11 Laurel was than Three Azimuth. He wondered how many ministers of war he'd served, and if the number was big enough to keep him from even being concerned when the current minister implied he wasn't loyal to her? Was that what was being said here? He felt like he was watching a conversation that had been going on for a long time, long before this meeting. 11 Laurel exhaled on a resigned sigh, all of the deep wrinkles in his face settling deeper.
Minister, it is not Nine Propulsion who concerns me. I hope she enjoys her retirement, of course, but she isn't minister now, is she? It is how much our Emperor trusts us here in war, now that she is gone and the Yautlek One Lightning has been sent off in disgrace. And how much Her Brilliance trusts creatures like Dismar, or information envoys, or anyone but her fleet on fleet business. That's all, Minister.
That's never all, Three Azimuth said, and ate antidote, trying to think through what 11 Laurel had just said. Did 19 Ads really not trust War? While War was defending all Tixkalan from incredibly dangerous aliens?
Practiced keeping his face as still as he could, as serene as a grown-up, calm as someone who wasn't trying to put all these pieces together. The Emperor had sent him to spy on War, though. Hadn't she? Maybe that meant 11 Laurel was right. He didn't know how he felt about that. Didn't know at all. Except that part of how he felt was scared.
The message they came up with was 11 seconds long and made up of four sounds spliced from the intercepted recording, repeated twice over. As far as Mahit could understand, and based on the best of her ability to communicate in sound waves that made her nauseated, it said something like, approach danger, contact initiated, hurrah we win, in sequence. And then, using their newfound unpleasant knowledge about how the alien noises increased in potency when they were layered on top of each other, played contact initiated from two opposite directions at once, and then added, hurrah we win, on top of that. Then it repeated again from the start. She wasn't sure that what she and Three Seagrass were saying was, come talk to us in person, it'll work out great. But she also wasn't not sure. And that was, well, it was the best they were going to do with this limited data set. Perhaps the message would get them more noises to work with, even if it didn't get them a live alien negotiator. They'd finished it, and the instant it was done, all of the fragile peace between them shattered like a glass dropped on the floor. Three Seagrass was sullen and silent and uncomprehending, and Mahit was exhausted. She had never wanted to have that fight.
That's not true, said Yaskander inside her mind, where his voice was almost exactly like hers, like her own thoughts were being operated by an external force, coming to the top of her mind with alien suddenness. You've been wanting to have that fight since the oration contest at Six Directions Banquet, when you saw how effortless being Tixkalanli was for her. Poetry competitions and all her glittering friends, and how much she likes aliens. You wanted to have it. You were just hoping you wouldn't have to.
She hated when he sounded like he knew everything. Like 20 years of extra experience and sleeping with the Emperor of all Tixkalan, both current and former versions thereof, made him an expert on how she felt. But then, he was inside her endocrine system. He knew how she felt, because he felt it the same. And they were getting closer all the time, more integrated. Her hands hurt. That sparkling ulnar nerve pain. Her head hurt too, like she'd been trying not to cry for a long time. I want her to see how she hurts me, she said, in the privacy of her own mind, while Three Seagrass put their message on a fresh infofiche stick and sealed it with her wax sealing kit, the flame orange wax the same color as her perfect, infuriating uniform. I want her to notice when she does, without being told.
She's a Tixkalanli Tzlim Mahit. They don't. Not unless you tell them over and over. And even then.
A slide. Sense memory and longing. The strange mirrored room of their shared mind reflecting a shard of time. The shape of 19 Adza's shoulder blades, delineated in the palest light of early morning in Palace East. How Yaskander had felt a terrifying, sweet tenderness. Felt it on some morning not too long before 19 Adz had let him, with her full knowledge and acquiescence, be murdered. Let him asphyxiate under the watchful eyes of Ten Pearl, Minister of Science. And yet the sense memory remained, even through death and botched imago surgery. Mahit looked at Three Seagrass and felt an echo of that tenderness, an echo of that betrayal. She's not going to kill me to save her emperor from corruption, she thought, pointedly.
I wouldn't underestimate her, Yaskander murmured. Not if I were in your place.
You are in my place.
She likes Mahit Dismar, not Yaskander Agavan. If she likes any part of us at all, after what we've said to her,
I'm going to present this to the Outlek, Three Seagrass said, light and chilly, and tucked the infofiche stick into the inner jacket pocket of her uniform. I'll make sure to point out that it's more than half your work. Thank you.
As if they'd never been anything but brief colleagues working on a difficult problem. Mahit felt as if she had broken the world, and hated herself for feeling that way. Three Seagrass, a secreta and patrician first class, third undersecretary to the Minister for Information, special envoy to the fleet. She wasn't the world. Mahit had done fine without her on LaSalle, had missed her only as much as she'd missed Takes Kalan, which was enormously and with aching frustration.
The world. The Empire. Iskander whispered, that single word in Takes Kalanli.
The right order of things, Mahit whispered back, which was just another shading of pronunciation. That was what felt broken, how she had wanted the world to be.
I assume, she found herself saying, that if it works and they do respond, you'll let me know.
Three Seagrass looked at her, a glancing, miserable expression, and dropped her eyes again.
Of course, she said, too fast. And I'll... when they respond, I want you to hear it.
It almost sounded like, I want you to help me. It would have been better, Mahit thought, if she'd actually said that. But Mahit hadn't particularly left her any room to do so, had she? She'd said, when you know why I had to come with you, then we can talk. And she hadn't meant, when you figure out the political situation on LaSalle Station, she'd meant, when you understand that when the Empire commands, I can't say no. She'd meant, when you understand that there's no room for me to mean yes, even if I want to. She'd meant, you don't understand that there's no such thing as being free. Free to choose, or free otherwise. So all she said out loud was, good. Until then, Three Seagrass. Three Seagrass didn't reply. She slipped out the door of the communications workroom like she couldn't wait to be gone, and left Mahit alone to try to do something about the remains of the vomit and find her way back to the quarters they were supposed to share. All those corridors between her and that limited safety, and her here, without the benefit of a uniform Takes Kalanli liaison to open all the doors, dispatch all the guardians. She crippled herself. On this fleet flagship, farther away from anything she could have ever called home than she'd ever been, for the sake of... what, exactly? For wanting an understanding that she, or at least the part of her that was Iskander, and it was hard to tell the difference between them now about this, wasn't even sure Three Seagrass was capable of comprehending, let alone having. What was the point of this? Mahit had thought she'd known. But now, she wasn't sure. The adjutant Ikantlos Prime 20 Cicada, Three Seagrass discovered, was ubiquitous. She hadn't gone much farther into the deep corridors of Wait for the Wheel, aiming, by Cloudhook map, away from the audio processing room and toward the general area of the bridge in hopes of encountering either the Yautlek or someone who knew where to fetch her from, when he simply materialized out of a three-way passage nexus, like the ship itself had manifested him.
There's never been a ship AI that took human form, Three Seagrass reminded herself. That's a holodrama plot, and besides, he's touched physical objects where I could see him do it. He is definitely a real person.
Nevertheless, she felt sufficiently a lot of things, but mostly exhausted and unhappy and brittle bright, ready to snap, that being surprised by 20 Cicada was downright spooky. Then she remembered that Fleet Captain 16 Moonrise had called him Swarm, which was a fascinatingly nasty nickname for someone who had a fascinatingly untoward name. An insect for his noun signifier. Swarm, though.
You're everywhere at once, she said to him, aren't you?
The light in the corridors of Wait for the Wheel was directionless. It made 20 Cicada's shaved head gleam, olive gold like patina on old coins. He seemed to consider this statement, tilting his head ever so slightly,
like he was calculating a vector of attack. Three Seagrass was going to have to look him up when she had access to the information network again. She wanted to know everything about his military record. Had he flown shards? Been in hand-to-hand combat? Or had he always been a logistics and operations officer, arranging the movements of ships and supply lines across jump gates under the peculiar spiritual guidance of his balance-obsessed religion?
"I'm where I should be," he said.
"I have the message we prepared for the Yautlek to broadcast," Three Seagrass told him, trying not to wince over the "we." She needed to not think about Mehit right now. She'd been doing so well not thinking about her. She wasn't going to start now. She needed to pay attention to what was happening right in front of her.
"Is she on the bridge?"
20 Cicada made a gesture with one hand that could mean "certainly" and could mean "I assume, if you like." It showed off the edges of his homostat cult tattoos, slipping out from the cuffs of his uniform in pale green fractal shapes. He was frustratingly difficult to read. Too strange and too exactly takes Kalanli soldier at the same time.
"Walk with me," he said,
instead of giving her a proper answer, and Three Seagrass decided that she would. They did not turn toward the bridge. Three Seagrass dismissed her Cloudhook's navigational function with a blink. It kept sending her small alerts at the corner of her vision that she really ought to have turned left, and now it had to recalculate her route, and she could do without that sort of petty annoyance. She set it to record her movements and build a new area map instead, as she had not done on LaSalle Station. And what did it mean that she was willing to conduct surveillance mapping of one of the Empire's flagships, and not a foreign sovereign state?
"It says," she thought deliberately,
like pressing on a bruise,
"that you trusted Mehit Dismar too much."
20 Cicada led her down two levels of the ship. He was not talkative, exactly. He asked questions, but not like an interrogator or an asecreta would. She couldn't put her hands on his goals. They were slippery.
"Have you seen what these aliens do to human beings?" he asked. "I believe Nine Hibiscus sent along some of the holo recordings of what we found on Paloa II.
She had. Three Seagrass had glanced through them and felt nothing.
"Oh, look, another war.
Someone else's atrocity, far away on the edges of the known world." But she was very close to those edges now.
"They like evisceration," she told 20 Cicada. "An interesting preference for mass casualties. Messy."
"Wasteful," he said, correcting her.
"What, because it takes too much effort to pull out the entrails on every single human being? You saw the claws the dead one has. It can't be that inefficient for them to do."
20 Cicada said,
"The dead creature was a scavenger, or its presentient ancestors were. That mouth, the eyes on the front of the skull. And yet it left all those guts to rot. That's wasteful."
They'd come to a heavily sealed door, airtight enough that Three Seagrass wondered for a moment if she was about to be unceremoniously spaced through an airlock. 20 Cicada stepped close to it, let it read his cloud hook. The clear glass over one eye flowed full of tiny gray-gold glyphs, like a storm boiling up over the city. It opened, and behind it was heat, and warm, wet air, and the scents of soil and growth and flowers. A hydroponics deck. Three Seagrass followed him inside with a gratitude she had not expected to feel. Her skin drank the moisture, starved for non-processed air. She wanted to luxuriate in it, a place on this ship that felt like Tix Kalan, like the jewel of the world, a garden heart. She took deep breaths. The drag of humidity in her lungs was delicious. 20 Cicada had much the same expression as she did, she suspected, a blissed relaxation of all the tension in his face. This was a place he loved. Of course he did. How could he not? Which meant, of course, that he'd brought her here to use it as a setting, a frame for the argument he was making to her, a place powerful enough to be worth a detour. Rather than bringing her and her work straight to the Yautlek, who had ordered it done. This argument must be deeply important to him. She'd listen. She'd rather have the second-in-command of a fleet flagship try to manipulate her with humidity and the amazing scent of rice, sorrel, and lotuses growing in hydroponic pools than think about Mahit Dasmar.
How many people do you feed?
She asked, following 20 cicada to the edge of one of the terraced pools. The effect was like standing on a balcony. They leaned on the fine wrought metal railings of a catwalk, looking down into green.
The capacity is 5,000, 20 cicada said, on emergency rations for 3 months. With weight for the wheel's usual crew numbers, we're entirely self-sufficient, at better than subsistence levels.
And enough flowers for every deck,
3 seagrass added.
All those lotuses.
As I said, better than subsistence.
Beauty, then, was part of his definition of self-sufficiency. 3 seagrass had always thought that homeostat cultists weren't supposed to like anything overly pretty or overly ugly. But this hydroponics deck was gorgeous. And so were all the lotuses. Every color, blue and silver pale, white, and the sort of pink that looked like sunrises.
What are the casualty rates looking like?
She inquired, after a moment of deliberate quiet, the both of them breathing the thick air like nectar.
Aside from Paloa 2, our casualty rates.
Don't you know?
He lifted the place where his eyebrow would be, under the cloud hook, as if to indicate her information issue dress.
We're not omniscient by virtue of being in the Information Ministry, Ikantlos Prime. And even if we were, there's a difference between reading reports and hearing from a soldier on the front.
20 cicada made a small, considering noise, a click of the tongue against the teeth.
Omniscience is somewhat crippled by lack of omnipresence, I'd agree. And too high. That's what our casualty rate is, too high, for a fleet that is waiting to decide what to do next, who has not yet found the source of these enemies, despite our best scouting efforts throughout the sector.
We don't know where they grow,
3 seagrass thought.
We don't even know what the garden heart of their home would look like, except that it wouldn't look like this deck, this place that 20 cicada values.
You'd prefer action, she said.
My preferences are hardly the point, envoy. I merely dislike waste and wasteful things.
And you think these aliens are offensive? Your word for offensive is wasteful.
3 seagrass wrapped her fingers around the railing, felt the slick dampness of the metal.
What would you ask them, if they do answer our message and come to talk to us?
This time the noise he made was not so considering.
What makes you think they're going to want to talk? No matter how clever you and the LaSalle ambassador have been in your sound splicing, oh bloody stars, one of them's gotten into the rice again.
One of what?
3 seagrass started. But 20 cicada had already swung his hips up over the railing and landed with a splash, water up above his knees and soaking the pants of his uniform. He waited with purpose and annoyance, paused, entirely still, like an ibis waiting to spear a fish with its beak, and ducked to grab a small dark shape from amongst the stalks of rice. It squalled. He held it out at arm's length by the scruff of its neck, and brought it back to her as if it was an unpleasant trophy.
Hold this, he said,
and shoved it through the bars of the railing for 3 seagrass to grab.
It's a cat, she said.
It was, a black kitten by the size of it, with enormous yellow eyes and the usual needle claws that kittens had, all of which were now sunk into 3 seagrass's jacket sleeve and her skin underneath. It was also dripping and damp, and unlike any other cat she had heard of, didn't seem perturbed by the water. 20 cicada clambered back onto the dry side of the balcony.
It was a cat, he said darkly, several thousand years ago before it became an arboreal pest that lives in the mangrove swamps on Kuran. An arboreal pest that has escaped into the air ducts of my ship because someone on the down planet team thought they were cute and brought back a pregnant one.
The kitten climbed onto Three Seagrass's shoulder. It was very sharp. It was also much better at holding on to her than she remembered kittens being. The last time she'd been close to a kitten, in the sitting room of some patrician's poetry salon back in the city. That kitten had been fluffy, pale, and uninterested in sitting on her shoulder. This one had very long phalanges, like the fingers of a human being, and a sort of thumb that was quite nearly opposable.
"They're in the air ducts?"
she repeated, dumbfounded and delighted.
"They, like me, are everywhere," said 20 Cicada, and sighed so as not to laugh. "And they shouldn't be in here. They're not native to the hydroponic ecosystem, and they're waste products of too much ammonia. You can have that one."
"What am I supposed to do with it?" Three Seagrass asked. "I have a report to give to the Yautlak Nine Hibiscus. I can't keep a kitten."
"It won't stay with you long. Just take it out with you, and leave it on a deck that isn't this one. And don't worry about Nine Hibiscus. I'll give you her message."
"Will you?"
Three Seagrass asked, knowing that what she was asking was closer to, "Ought I to trust you, now that you've shown me how little you think these enemies are worth talking to at all?"
"Nine Hibiscus asked for it," said her adjutant, as if this fact rendered the universe entirely simple. "So I'll bring it to her. I always know where she is."
He could have gone straight to 19 ads right after he left the Ministry of War. There was no reason not to. It would be suspicious. 8 Antidote lived in Palace Earth, same as the Emperor did, and he went to see her all the time. And he did have, well, not actionable intelligence like people talked about in spywork holodramas, but useful information of the kind that her brilliance had specifically asked for. He could have walked right in. But it felt wrong. It felt like being a tattletale, not a spy. Like being someone else's ears instead of his own person, making his own decisions. He would tell her about Ambassador Mahit Dismar and Fleet Captain 16 Moonrise, of course, and maybe, probably, about 11 Laurel's concern that her brilliance didn't trust the War Ministry. He'd even tell her today. But first he wanted to really understand, for himself, what he'd learned. Which was why 8 Antidote had walked into the lobby of the Information Ministry, announced himself with all of his titles, and asked the nice Asekrita trainee, who was staffing the public information desk, to find him someone who could spare a half hour to explain rapid communications through jump gates to the future emperor of all Tixkalan. "It's for my education," 8 Antidote had said, extremely cheerfully, and the trainee had actually stifled a conspiratorial giggle behind her hand. "Yes," he thought, "you're helping the heir to the empire with his homework. Keep thinking that." He only had to wait a little while, and he kept himself amused by looking at the way the Information Ministry presented itself. So different from the 6 outreaching palms. Clear and clean, serenely white marble walls coupled with ever-present coral-colored accents, like the sleeves of their asekritim had bled into the architecture. Coral inlay on the floor, done in a carnelian stone mosaic of an enormous chrysanthemum, framed by smaller lotuses. "Eternity," 8 Antidote remembered, from some very long ago tutoring session when he'd been extremely small, hardly older than a baby. Everybody learned flowers first. Chrysanthemums are eternity, and lotuses are memory and rebirth, which is why the Information Ministry sigil has got both. They like to think that they know everything and always have and always will. Or at least that's what 11 Laurel would say. He wasn't sure what he'd say. Yet. The person who showed up to talk to him was a round, broad-shouldered man with an open sort of face. The kind of face that seemed friendly even when it wasn't. A good face for an Information Ministry employee.
"Your Excellency," he said, "I understand you would like to discuss interstellar communication."
8 Antidote made himself look like his ancestor the Emperor, composed his mouth and eyes into that same knowing, interested, serene expression that had made 19 ads flinch back from him in surprised recognition. He was getting good at it. It worked even on people who hadn't known his ancestor so well. It was an adult expression, and people got nervous in a useful way when he made it with his kid's face. "I would very much," he said, "if I'm not taking up your valuable time, Asegreta. I'm terribly sorry, I didn't catch your name."
"One cyclamen, Your Excellency," said the Asegreta. "And I have the honor of being the second subsecretary of the Epistolary Department of the Ministry of Information, which means I am the person who spends a great deal of time on the intricacies of interstellar communication through jump gates. A process, Your Excellency, which is so very automated and regular that my time is absolutely most valuably spent on informing you about it. Would you like to come into a conference room?"
One cyclamen was amazingly obsequious, and in such a way that Eight Antidote felt more flattered than annoyed. He wished he could learn that skill. "Yes, please," he said, and wondered what the camera eyes of the city would think of him now, following an information agent into a white and beige conference room. No holographic strategy tables here, no star chart outlines of the universe, only a holoprojector at one end of a regular sort of table, decorously turned down to a low flicker of light. The chairs were too big for him. His feet didn't touch the floor, so he tucked them up under himself, sitting cross-legged. It was better than letting them swing. He felt steadier. "How does a message get to the jewel of the world from thousands of light years away in just a few hours, Second Subsecretary?" he asked in tones of high politeness, as if he was speaking to one of his tutors. "And can it go faster than usual, or slower?"
"In the most technical sense, a message cannot go faster or slower than it can be routed through a jump gate, Your Excellency," said one cyclamen. "The jump gates are our sticking point. Forgive me, you do understand how they work, do you not?"
"If I get confused, I'll tell you," Eight Antidote said, and folded his hands together to make a cup for his chin, looking up at one cyclamen intently. Everyone knew how jump gates worked. They were like narrow mountain passes. The only way to get from one side to the other was through the aperture. Except instead of two pieces of land with a mountain range dividing them, one side was a sector of space, and the other side was a completely different one, which could be anywhere. There wasn't a connection between the sectors, except for through the gates and some sectors of Tixkalanli space. Well, no one knew exactly where they were in terms of vectors away from the jewel of the world. But you could get there, just as easily as you could take the subway out to Plaza Central 9, if you knew which jump gate to go through. And if you didn't, you'd have to crawl at sublight speeds across the galaxy, hoping to run into where you meant to go before you died. Jump gates were why the Empire worked. One cyclamen was talking, and had been talking for several seconds, and Eight Antidote wasn't sure if it was good or bad that he had apparently learned to look like he was paying attention when he wasn't.
"Electronic communication is essentially transmittable at faster-than-light speeds, practically instantaneous, via our signaling stations within a sector, and has been for hundreds of years. But only physical objects can go through a jump gate, and only non-physical ones can be transmitted via the Imperial Signal Service. You see the problem?"
"Someone has to carry the message on an infofiche stick through every jump gate between its origin and destination."
"Yes, which is why I have a job, Your Excellency, incidentally. Or why my job exists. The Epistolary Department staffs the jump gate postal services. We're the only information workers who fly spaceships, though they're quite short little flights, back and forth through the jump gate with the mail. And most of them are automated these days."
Eight Antidote nodded. "Unpiloted ships?"
"It's a very simple routing algorithm," one cyclamen said, shrugging. "No reason to use a person unless it is a rush job, or the jump gate is very tricky or heavily trafficked."
A rush job? Like 16 moonrises. Had information passed the very message that was so anti-information? Did information read the physical messages? Or did they merely arrive, a pile of infofiche sticks like the worst possible heap of unanswered palace mail? Eight Antidote imagined a sack of the things, or a series of crates, and was a bit horrified at the idea of so many messages all at once. He didn't ask how a rush job got scheduled. That would be too obvious. And he was being a spy today. It was possible that once a person started being a spy, they were going to be one forever, which was definitely something he would need to think about later. What he asked instead was, "Does information process everyone's mail? From all of Tixkalan?" One cycloman paused. There was a faint line between his eyebrows, a tension line, like he just remembered that he was talking to an Imperial heir and not any creche kid doing an enrichment project.
"We don't process," he said. "We transmit. Unless ordered to do otherwise by Her Brilliance, the Emperor, of course, but I'm sure that's not what you meant, Your Excellency. Perhaps you wanted to know if there were other mail carriers."
"Are there?" said Eight Antidote, and waited. The waiting was another adult trick, a 19 ads trick. She did it to him all the time, made him answer questions while not knowing why she'd asked them, and learned what he was thinking by how he answered, whether he wanted her to or not.
"Aside from the fleet, which carries its own orders on its own ships, no official ones," one cycloman said. "But any vessel moving through a jump gate can carry a message with them, of course. And then there are sector-wide mail services, a great number, some governmental and some private businesses. Would you like a list? I can have one prepared and sent to your cloud hook."
He wasn't about to turn down information, even if it wasn't information he currently could think of any actual use for. Except for that moment where one cycloman had said, "The fleet carries its own orders on its own ships." Had 16 Moonrise's message come in that way? "I'd like that," he said. "Thank you." Then he paused, as if he was suddenly remembering another question, and leaned forward on his elbows, smiling wide-eyed. "I'm 11. I'm small. I'm harmless. I'm doing my homework." And asked one more question. "Has anyone ever delayed jump gate mail, or captured it, or changed it, or sent it through other jump gates than the ones it was routed to?" One cycloman laughed. Eight Antidote thought it was the kind of laughter that was meant to cover being uncomfortable.
"Like pirates, Your Excellency. Mail pirates."
Eight Antidote shrugged. "Maybe. Go on. Tell me how this process can be fooled or accelerated or stopped."
"Historically, there have been a few incidents, of course, but we try very hard to prevent them. And truly significant messages go through on fleet ships, of course, just like the fleet's own orders. Diplomatic communiques, imperial proclamations."
"There. Because fleet ships have right-of-way through jump gates."
"Quite so, Your Excellency. If something needs to move fastest, it will be on a fleet ship. But do be assured that the Information Ministry doesn't lose your letters."
"I would never think that," Eight Antidote said, cheerfully. That tension line in one cycloman's forehead deepened. "Thank you so very much for spending time with me and answering all these questions."
"Of course, giving out information, well, that's what we're for, here in information."
"Yes," Eight Antidote thought. "That's what you're for. And I wonder how many of your jump gate postal offices 16 Moonrise skipped right over when she sent that message to the Minister of War. I bet it was most of them. And 11 Laurel doesn't mind that kind of circumventing protocols. Not when what's being circumvented is the Information Ministry." If she stayed on this ship for much longer, Mahit thought grimly, as she turned one last corner and finally arrived at the sealed door of the quarters she and Three Seagrass had been assigned. She was going to have to find some way to requisition a cloud hook, for navigation's sake, if nothing else. Wait for the Wheel was a tenth the size of LaSalle Station, and many thousands of times smaller than the Jewel of the World. And yet here, neither her nor Yaskander's knowledge of place sufficed for not having to ask, humiliatingly, for directions. More than once. At least she'd been headed away from the more restricted decks instead of into the ship's heart, no one asked her why a barbarian was alone, so far away from barbarian territory.
Either that, or the ship's AI updated itself and you show up as a legitimate passenger,
Iskander said to her. He sounded as pissed off and frustrated as she felt. She wanted to throw something, break something lovely, some gorgeous piece of Tixkalani decor she could knock off a table and shatter. Maybe there would be one inside the quarters. How she was going to share a room with Three Seagrass after what they had done to each other, she wasn't thinking about right now. It wasn't the current problem. On the touchpad lock next to the door was a piece of sticky disposable plastifilm, which read, "Your password is void." The Tixkalani glyph shaped like a giant hollow circle. For a moment, Mahit wasn't sure what she was supposed to do if her door unlocking code was already expired. And then she realized it was a preset, an easy glyph to draw to unlock your room before you could change the code. She unpeeled the plastifilm and drew a void on the touchpad, and the door hissed open. Silhouetted against the light from the room's single lamp was a tall, narrow figure. It took a step toward Mahit. She had dropped to her knees on the floor before she quite knew why, a flare of white-out panic, and then she was rolling toward the figure, getting her feet under her and throwing herself at the figure's legs in a headlong, tackling leap. They collided. Her shoulders spasmed like she'd hit it with a hammer or a knee, and the person she'd hit fell heavily over her, grunting, their palms striking the floor in a slap. "Where's the needle?" Mahit thought. "I have to get away from the needle. It's poison." Whoever it was rolled down her shoulder and somersaulted to their feet, leaving Mahit in a heap on the floor, scrambling away, waiting for the sharp prick and the end of everything. "Stop it," Iskander said, as loud in her mind as if he'd been next to her and shouting, "You're not dying. You're not in the city. This isn't 11 Conifer. Stop it." "You're not dying." How many times had she said that to him, in the middle of the night, when he'd woken them up from dreams of asphyxiation? "You do not take surprise as well," said the intruder, and Mahit shoved her hair out of her eyes and managed to look up, focusing. She had just attacked Fleet Captain 16 Moonrise, and came out rather the worse for it. The fleet captain looked entirely unperturbed, not a hair out of place. Mahit felt her face go dark with an embarrassed flush. "Just because I was ambushed in my apartment once shouldn't mean I react like this every time I'm surprised by someone in a room," she thought miserably, and got nothing but Yaskander's rueful and sympathetic acknowledgement in return.
"No," she managed. "I don't. My apologies, I didn't intend to assault you, Fleet Captain."
A slim, pale gold hand appeared in front of her, offering, and Mahit took it. 16 Moonrise pulled her up to her feet.
"It's quite understandable," she said. "I didn't know you'd been in combat, Ambassador Dismar. I ought to have left a note on the door, but I did want to talk to you alone."
"I haven't been in combat," Mahit said. I failed the physical combat aptitudes by 18 points. I've never been near combat."
"One hardly needs good aptitudes to have ended up in situations where combat happens,"
16 Moonrise said, dismissively. "And regardless, you have good instincts. Shall we sit down?" Mahit's mouth tasted of adrenaline, bitter and metallic, and she was shaking very slightly. There seemed to be no plausible way, barring another attempt at bodily force, to remove the fleet captain from the room. And the first attempt had been bad enough. She glanced around, looking for something to sit on, or at, and found that there was a small folding desk which had already been pulled down from the wall, and two stools, one on either side of it. 16 Moonrise must have been here for a while. She'd had time to prepare. Probably she hadn't expected Mahit to get horribly lost in the ship and had gotten bored enough to investigate the furniture. Mahit was being hysterical, even in the privacy of her own mind. What limited privacy her own mind had, anyway? She sat, gestured at the other stool. "Welcome to my office, such as it is. and folded her hands tightly together in her lap, willing them to stop shaking.
"I imagine you're wondering why I've been waiting for you," said 16 Moonrise, taking the opposite seat.
Mahit nodded, a rueful bit of acquiescence. 16 Moonrise folded her hands on the table where Mahit could see them, mirroring, establishing rapport.
"I can't handle an interrogation," she thought, miserably. "Not now."
"Pull yourself the fuck together," Iskander told her. "Even if she's a third Palmer or trained that way, and I think she might be, they're the military spies, the interrogators. She's a soldier, and she needs you for something. Pay attention, Mahit."
Mahit took a breath, settled back on her pelvis, straightened her spine. She was of a height with 16 Moonrise, at least when they were both sitting down.
"From your reaction to Special Envoy 3 Seagrass and me," she said, "I would expect nearly anything except you waiting for me, Fleet Captain."
"What was it you said? The spook and her pet?"
"I did say that,"
16 Moonrise agreed, easily enough, and didn't apologize for it.
"She is a spook and you are, or you certainly were, brought here as her pet. I imagine she told you all sorts of things about how your presence could ensure a diplomatic voice for the stations in whatever negotiations she ends up conducting with her enemies, yes?"
Not quite, Mahit thought. That would have been transparent. This is 3 Seagrass. Transparency is beyond her, beyond us both. She lifted one hand from her lap, tilted it back and forth. "Maybe yes, maybe no. Go on." "16 Moonrise said, an evaluating noise.
"Why are you here, Ambassador Dismar? I imagined you'd want to be shut of Tixkalan, after being involved in that mess in the capital 3 months ago."
"I like challenges," Mahit said. "I'm a translator. Who wouldn't want to be involved in a first contact scenario?"
"Nearly everyone who has ever been near an alien," said 16 Moonrise. "I don't believe you, Ambassador Dismar. Glory-seeking naivete does not match up with the woman who started this war for us. Your broadcast before Six Directions' death was masterful, by the way. You horrified me, and I don't horrify easily."
"With all due respect, Fleet Captain, it was the aliens who started this war. I alerted the Emperor to it. I considered it an act of good citizenship."
"You're a barbarian."
"Barbarians," Mahit said, imagining 3 Seagrass's face the whole time she was saying it, "are human beings. Good citizenship in the face of existential threats extends beyond the boundaries of sovereignty. Or at least that is what we barbarians are taught on my station."
It wasn't.
Mahit had never been taught anything of the kind. But it made 16 Moonrise's electrum-colored eyes widen, not a smile and not a grimace, but a veritable hit. And it was a useful lie. 16 Moonrise exhaled through her nose as if in exasperation.
"Let me put it this way, Ambassador," she said. "I've watched your work on the news feeds during One Lightning's idiotic little usurpation attempt, which the fleet really could have done without, by the way. You're too smart and too much of a politician to be here only as the envoy's pet, and you're already having difficulties with the envoy, aren't you? I notice she isn't here, and you aren't on the bridge with the outlek, not to mention that your precious stations are right next to this sector, which is full of aliens with ship-dissolving spit. One jump gate away. That's not very far at all."
"I've seen the holographs of Paloa too," Mahit said. "Is it so strange that I'd want to be part of stopping what is happening here? And yes, stopping it from reaching my home as well." She wasn't going to talk about 3 Seagrass. It was bad enough that 16 Moonrise, who was clearly no friend to either of them, had noticed that there was something wrong between them, and noticed from only the evidence of an absence. She wasn't going to confirm it, not now, not ever.
"It's not strange," said 16 Moonrise, lifting one shoulder in a shrug. "It's merely interesting.
You show up in the most fascinating places, Ambassador, and you seem to be quite convinced by the envoy's argument that talking to our enemies will deliver the halt to hostilities you so reasonably desire. You think otherwise?
Oh, I reserve judgment until an attempt is made, said 16 Moonrise.
And for a moment, Mahit could see how she would be as a commander, the sort of person who evaluated and evaluated and then struck, a flurry of orders and decisions, no hesitation.
But I have lost 27 soldiers in the past week, and I am beginning to be sick of funeral hymns. I have what I would consider perfectly reasonable doubts about the envoy's efficacy, and yours, at first contact negotiations at least.
You may be a very skillful barbarian, Mahit Dismar, and you may have wrapped the Information Ministry around your finger like a satellite caught in orbit. But you're no Emperor to Sunspot, and these things aren't the Abrekti.
Mahit found it within herself to laugh. It wasn't her laugh, exactly. It was some sort of self-mocking amusement that belonged mostly to the younger, half-dissolved Yaskander. His flash-fire arrogance and bravado.
They're worse than the Abrekti, based merely on their noises. Did you know those sounds function as a self-reinforcing amplifying sine wave when played from different directions, Fleet Captain?
I thought not.
And I am certainly much worse than her brilliance to Sunspot, as a negotiator and as a person with weight on the world. I would never compare myself to an emperor of all Tixkalan.
It felt good to say, to be vicious in her own despair, to display the wound of her desire in full.
No, I will not be Tixkalanli. I am incapable, I know. Let me hold the bleeding lips of this injury open for you to see the raw hurt inside.
To say, I would never compare myself to one of you, with full consciousness that she would, and had, and could not stop.
Like a reflection, a shard of memory, hers or Yaskander's, too blurred to discern. 19 ads saying,
it's a shame you're not one of us. You argue like a poet.
Or had that been 3 Seagrass? She couldn't tell. She wished she could. It might mean something. If she could remember if that had been her or Yaskander, the now emperor or the Asekrita, wishing for her, for them, to be otherwise than they were.
Ah, said 16 Moonrise. And yet you have willingly tried to bring them to a negotiating table.
I use, Mahit said, feeling very tired and very cold. What skills I have available.
As does your station, I see. What skills and what people.
And she doesn't even know for certain that I'm a spy, Mahit thought. Here for herself, and her station, surely, and here also for Dash Taratz, in payment for how he would spare her from Heritage's scans and knives. Her eyes were only her own, until she made her first report back to him. And once she did that, she might have to choose whether or not she would be a saboteur, as well as a spy, to keep being spared.
This one, Yaskander told her, as her fingers went numb, as her forearms went numb to the elbow. She thought they were getting better, but this was worse, much worse than it had been in a while. This one doesn't need to know, to have already decided. For her, all barbarians are spies and saboteurs, if they're somewhere as secret and sacred as a Tixkalanli flagship of the fleet. How could they be otherwise?
Would you prefer we sent fighter ships rather than ambassadors? Mahit asked the fleet captain. We have a few. Not nearly so many as Tixkalan, of course.
16 Moonrise looked at her, considering and expressionless.
There may be a time, Ambassador, that we need every ship we can find, she said. At that time, I'll remind you of what you've said to me. And until then, well, good luck with the envoy and the aliens and the Yautlek. I assume stationers believe in luck?
When we need it, Mahit said. You'll need it, said 16 Moonrise, and left Mahid at the work table alone, vanishing into the hallway as if she had never been lying in wait for her at all. Mahid put her face in her numb hands, numb elbows on the table, and pressed the heels of her palms against her eyes. The last thing she wanted to do was cry. She didn't have time to cry. She had to think about why 16 Moonrise, a fleet captain, out of place, drifting through a flagship not her own, sneaking into the rooms of information agents and barbarian ambassadors, would have wanted to challenge her, test her motivations, warn her, if it was a warning and not a threat, of how little the fleet wanted to talk to these aliens, how much they wanted to kill them instead. How inconsequential the desires of information agents, barbarian ambassadors, and even Yautlekum might be, against the long weight of habitual violence that was the Tixkalanli legions. When she exhaled, hard through her nose, trying to expel all the spent air from her lungs and start again, her jacket rustled, like it was full of paper. Like the jacket she'd worn in the city had been full of ciphertext instructions for how best to start this war and prevent LaSalle from being devoured by Tixkalan. It had crackled the same way. And she reached into her inner jacket pocket and came up with The Perilous Frontier, a graphic story exactly the size of a political pamphlet. She'd forgotten she'd bought it.
You forgot to take it out of your jacket. That's even more distracted than I forgot I bought it.
Aknel Amnadbat was very distracting, Mahid told Yaskandar. At the time.
And then, finding herself hoping for a distraction that was neither tears nor Aknel Amnadbat, she opened it and began to read. Graphic stories had never been of particular interest to Mahid as a literary form. They'd always seemed unnecessarily hybrid, not quite holoprog, not quite still art, not quite prose. And as a child, all right, as an adult as well, and continuously, most of what she read when she had time to read for pleasure was in Tixkalanli. The Perilous Frontier was in Stationer, drawn by stationers and written by stationers for stationers. How old had the kid at the kiosk been who'd sold it to her? 17 at most. Mahid hadn't been any good at being 17. She wouldn't have known what to do with an artist collective writing graphic stories if one had been tossed at her head when she was 17. Reading it, volume one of an as-yet-incomplete cycle of at least 10, felt more like an anthropological exercise than anything else. The protagonist, Captain Cameron, a pilot from a long Imago line of pilots, was on the first spread in the midst of getting into nasty trouble, trying to fly through an asteroid cluster, apparently aiming for an abandoned mine and some other character trapped in it. Mahid didn't know if she was supposed to know what was going on, or if there was some sort of volume zero she'd missed. Yaskandar was no help. Graphic stories hadn't been youth culture fashion when he'd been young at all. Mahid found herself grasping for the background, the referentiality and citation that she'd expect in a Tixkalanli text, even an unfamiliar one, and didn't find it.
It figures, Yaskandar told her, all the older Yaskandar, amused, world-weary, faintly intrigued, that the one thing we'd have to read would be stationer native art, written by teenagers who haven't taken the aptitudes yet. Go on, turn the page. I want to see what happens next.
What happened next was Captain Cameron dodged an ice comet, flew in close to an asteroid large enough to have an atmosphere of its own, practically a planetoid, and searched grimly through the snow that atmosphere was producing for a person named Esharakir Lurut and the secret archive of ancient LaSalle documents that she had apparently hidden in said abandoned mine. Lurut was drawn thin, attenuated, an exaggerated version of how someone might look if they were much younger than their imago, and also had eaten nothing but protein cakes for months. It was impressive art. Mahid couldn't imagine sitting still for long enough to draw all of this in ink, by hand, and make it look so evocative, without any colors at all.
Isharakir Lurud had been hiding documents to preserve them in their original forms. Cameron was there to rescue her, or the documents, and the majority of the middle of the story was Lurud arguing that, yes, she would come back, and with the documents. But that Cameron had to promise to support her versions, rather than the official, heritage-sanctioned ones, when they got back to the station. Otherwise, she wasn't going anywhere at all. She'd stay in a mine on an asteroid in the snow and wait for someone else to agree to defend the memory of LaSalle.
"This is amazingly subversive," Yaskander said to Mahit. "Anti-heritage, by way of being more heritage than heritage. And teenagers wrote this?"
"Wrote and drew," Mahit thought. "I guess there's a reason it's the same size as a political pamphlet after all."
"Perhaps we're not the only ones who have reasons to dislike Aknel Amnarbad."
"I haven't been home long enough to know why artist kids would be angry." And even if Mahit had, she wouldn't have ever been friends with these people, who made art out of ink and paper, about stationer memory, stationer art, stationer politics. She'd always spent her time with the other Taixkalan-obsessed students, writing poetry, imagining the city. The perilous frontier was as alien to her as, oh, not quite as alien as the beings that had made the sickening noises she and Three Seagrass had been trying to work with, but almost. Or felt that way, at least.
"Good thing you didn't give her your jacket," Iskander said. "This would be hard to read with the pages stuck together with vomit."
Mahit winced and shut the book. "I don't want to talk about Three Seagrass."
"Or think about her. But you keep doing it."
Mahit pictured Three Seagrass reading The Perilous Frontier, all despite herself, and wished her Imago was less right about what she thought and how it made her feel. But he felt it too. More and more, all the time.